Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief, as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Griefsters. Welcome back to Season 3 of the Griefcast. Thank you so much for coming back if you're an old listener. And welcome if you're a new listener to Cheery Chats About Death. I hope you all had lovely summers or winters, depending on where you listen. I've been corrected on that before. So look forward to jumpers or look forward to flip-flops, depending on where you are. I ate a lot of ice cream and I got in the sea. Can't ask more than that. Can you really? Could ask for a second referendum, but it's not going to happen. We have some amazing guests coming up, so please do subscribe, then you'll never miss an episode. And also, if you do like the show or even a particular episode, please feel free to rate and review it as well. That would be much appreciated. And thank you if you've done so already. I do read all the comments and I'm always so, so touched at them. We also have a live episode coming up on September the 15th in London at King's Place. We're taking part in the London Podcast Festival. I'll be joined by Andrew Hunter-Murray from No Such Thing as a Fish, Erin Gibson from Throwing Shade, and Dane Baptiste, a brilliant stand-up comic and star of his own BBC Three sitcom, Sunny D. That's a hell of a lineup. If you head to the King's Place website, you can find tickets there, but I would hurry because I think they are nearly gone. Run while you're still alive. Is that okay? That's fine. This week's guest is the amazing Aisling B. Aisling is one of the most talented and funny, brilliant people I know in my life. She is an actor, a stand-up, a writer, and a general legend. You might have seen her on The Fool doing her acting, or on 8 Out of 10 Cats doing her comedy. And she has a new comedy Netflix special. She's on a show called The Comedy Lineup. If you head to Netflix, you can see her doing her stand-up there. She really is an incredibly funny and clever, brilliant person, and it was an absolute honour to talk to her. She came in to talk to me about her dad, who took his own life when she was a child. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here today with actor, comedian and writer Aisling B.
What up, what up?
Hello, Aisling.
Hello, Carrie.
I always say everyone's names really weirdly and I decided just to make a thing of it, just to go. I always go, Aisling B, like that, like a weirdo.
Yeah, because I know you, so
I know.
It's weird.
It's even weirder, isn't it?
I just call you C-Unit.
Tiny Dancer is what you normally call
me. I do call you Tiny Dancer.
I love.
For those of you who are listening, and I know you're probably listening for grief-orientated chat, but let me tell you, this tiny lady's arse moves like I've never seen. Do you remember
so
in those sing-along songs for Disney, they'd have like a bouncing ball on the words?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They could have easily used Carrie-Anne Lloyd's rear end. I've never seen anything like the way Carrie-Anne dances.
I make it, the joke I used to say, like, someone once said to me, like, how did you learn to dance like that? And I said, low self-esteem.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
It's the same low self-esteem look in their eyes, a kind of, you know, women who aren't given characters in rap music videos.
Yeah, yeah.
They just kind of grind in the background. Like, they're not trained dancers. They're just grinders.
I wrote a sketch about it once of, like, the background girls, but they were all, like, dancing. And then one, it was a bit, actually, I think I realised it was a copy of Mitchell and Webb because they were dancing and they were like, what do you mean this isn't feminist?
Yeah.
We just look good. And someone was like, I don't think they're seeing our faces. And the other ones were like, what? No, we're the stars. They were like, I think the camera's on our ass.
Oh, that was us when we were teenagers, yeah. Just bumping and grinding.
But
now we got dead Swede self-esteem almost up and we still bumping and grinding.
Like
and it's
10%
just
up, I reckon.
I think I'm about 12%
oh,
now.
Oh, that's good. So, Ashley, who are we remembering today?
Who are we remembering? Well, I'll be honest, Carrie-Anne. I felt a little bit grumpy coming here today.
I bet, yeah, yeah.
And I knew I was going to be seeing one of my best pals, Carrie-Anne Lloyd, arse of the year. 1980 whatever to current
on,
year. I wrote an article about my dad who died, it'll be 31 years this Saturday.
Wow. Oh, this Saturday.
This Saturday up. And I wrote, and for those of you who don't know, I wrote an article about his suicide in November. And I'd never discussed it with most of my friends, la la la. But then suddenly went public with it and I didn't expect the overwhelming response from it.
Yeah.
And it's funny because in one way as well, some days I realise that being mildly in the public eye and being a public figure and talking about a subject like suicide, which nobody wants to talk about because it comes across as zero crack to bring up at a dinner party. If everyone's discussing their favourite songs or TV shows or box sets that they've watched, I'm like, when am I going to talk about suicide, guys? But it really threw me for six. And I think I've spent the year a little bit getting over the reaction, which I was so touched by and so honoured by the amount of people who've been in touch. But there are some days where I'm really happy to talk about it, for it to be out there. And there are some days when I don't maybe totally want my life to be a product or a thing you do on a podcast.
Oh,
and last weekend I did, and I don't think I realised how I need to take a little breather in between. And it was interesting because on one hand I was like, maybe I should text Carrie-Anne. On the other hand I was like, no, maybe for this podcast in particular, this is exactly where it should be, because I think today I feel a little grief struck, which I haven't felt talking about it before. And last weekend I did this Irish sports show that a friend of mine runs, and it's all about this sporting life or your sporting life. And I talked about,
because you're a brilliant mother,
my mother, jockey. Yes, who is a retired flat race jockey. And you know, she didn't totally find it easy with the article coming out and stuff like that, because she buried a husband, raised two kids on her own, and then all of a sudden people are just coming up to her in the street going, I read your daughter's article, Helen, and grab it. And it's sort of, I think, brought her back a lot. And my story to tell, but I did this radio interview and it came out on Saturday, and because I was sort of bigging her up in the article and stuff like that, and rightly so, she's amazing. I think that was the first time I felt like she was sort of proud of me, but it sort of knocked me off kilter a little bit at the start of this week, again, having the messages come in and stuff like that. And and again, I always say, if it helps you to write a message to a random stranger you've seen on some random panel show, do it. Send me a message. Send it to my Facebook page. Send it to my Twitter, wherever you want to send it. Maybe don't find my address and send it to my house, people. That is creepy. But do it. I will read every single one of them. I haven't been able to get back to the majority of them. But some days... and I had this recently at MacFest. So I'm working on a new show where this will be part. I want to explore masculinity. I want to explore femininity in it. I want to explore death and suicide, because I do believe you can do comedy about it. I do believe you can, no matter what happened, you can make comedy out of stuff. I believe there's bad jokes and jokes that just don't work.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and you can totally get it wrong. But yeah. I don't believe any subject matter is off the table.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just think it's like who's saying it, what their voice is, what way are you punching. So I also think that about suicide. But when I was doing McCuntleth Comedy Festival, I decided to do an hour where I'd touch upon it in the middle of the hour. And I was, you know, that was me trying at the subject
matter.
Yeah,
seeing how it felt.
Yeah, and I couldn't believe how nervous I was. Because that day... And I knew I had to do it because it's rare that you get an hour to go and explore the subject matter.
Yeah, and in a nice place like Mac.
And the audience were all going to be on side and it was nice. And, you know, I just did not want that day to have... I wanted to go back a year.
Yeah.
Just that day.
Yeah.
And today is one of those days where it just... And I thought to myself, oh, today is a perfect day to do this podcast. A, I'm with my pal. B, it's called the Grief Cast, and I think...
No one's expecting you, like, the happy version of this world.
Yes, exactly.
Everyone's like, yeah, I totally get
that. But also what's interesting, I suppose, is from a listener's point of view, if you're listening, I talk about this stuff now publicly in a way I've decided to talk about it and to maybe know that there are days when everyone... And sometimes it feels silly because, like, he died now 31 years ago.
Oh, mate, yeah, but I think, 20 years, I'm in that
club. And you feel a bit silly. You're like, come on, mate.
I feel so embarrassed sometimes. Like, I honestly feel like sometimes I interview guests and they're sat in that chair and I say to them, like, they maybe haven't heard the show properly or something, and they'll say, oh, it was 2 years ago and I'm very upset. And they go, oh, how long's yours? And I say, 20. And I see this look on their face and they're like, oh, my God, am I going to have to talk about this for 20 years? And you're like, no, you might not.
Yeah.
You might be one of those people like my brother who doesn't bring it up at every single conversation.
Yes, and that's okay. That's
and
totally
okay.
That's
totally fine, but it's...
I think for me, maybe because I went through different waves. So my dad died when I was 3, and until I was 13, I remember him being in the house. Like, I didn't really feel like he went anywhere.
Wow.
Like, my mother said that I used to, like, go to the door every time I heard a car go by and expect him to be him coming round in the house. And I still remember... I remember the day he died because I remember my mother had been cleaning the floor. It's one of my first few memories. Some of my memories that I have, I'm not sure if they're photographs I looked at for so long I turned them into moving pictures.
Yeah.
And I honestly can't tell you if they're true or not.
That's so common with memories. I've heard that a lot with bereaved kids. So
yeah,
it's like,
you don't know what it is.
Yeah, you nothing's stable because it went too quickly for your brain to form it.
The one I definitely know is true is that I know my mother was cleaning the floor because she put all the chairs into the kitchen sitting room where there's a carpet so she could, like, wash the kitchen floor. And when the men came in to tell her, we had to sit, everyone was sat on those chairs. And I think I remember because I'm like, no, you don't sit in the sitting room when the chairs are in the sitting room. You wait for the floor to dry and then we'll sit out at the table. That's where they mainly sit. And I also remember someone just giving me a My Little Pony. And I remember thinking, this is great. Whatever's happened is fantastic. Because if I could get some sweet and My Little Ponies every single time it happens, then yas, queen.
Yeah. So you were 3 and your sister's younger than you?
Yes. So she was just 3 months old. So she was just a baby.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was a lot. It was a lot.
Fuck.
That's why I always... I think I'm not the perfect combination. I think I'm a combination. Perfectly of two people.
Yeah.
My father's side of the family are all poets and maybe slightly more maybe depressives in their manner. And then my mother's side of the family are, they just have this zest for life that is unbelievable. Now, what comes with that is maybe an ability to understand when you're down, but not empathize.
Yeah.
I often think that if the war was on, it was wartime spirit, my mother's family would be the people who kind of rebuild the house and the bridges.
Fine.
And they go, how many people do lose Mavis? Oh, 10 daughters, 5 kids, like 5 sons. They're all dead, but on we go, make a cup of tea. And then my dad's family would be the ones who write poetry about it all.
Yeah.
And you need both, but I think maybe...
Yeah, you do, and it depends what's happening in the world. Do you know what I mean?
Like,
I agree with you.
You need someone to play the fiddle by the side as well. They're normally the homeless people after the war and absolutely of no help, practically. But I think that maybe I'm I have both sides in me.
Yeah.
And even though my father took his own life, my mother's energy and will to live... She doesn't hold on to grudges. I've never seen anything like it. Until I was about in my 20s, I was so angry. And I was like, I was like that American Hollywood movie, The Grudge Man. I was so grudgy. I was angry at my father. I would because
of course,
I
of course.
Only found out that he had taken his own life when I was 13. And
what happened? Did someone sit you down?
Yeah, my mother thought it was about time we knew.
Yeah.
And the thing is, there still isn't enough. And why I wanted to talk about it was there just aren't enough people talking about suicide because it's so hard to understand. How do you say, I'm really sorry someone is dead about someone who technically took their own life? Mm. It's a really hard,
especially to a teenager.
To anyone grieving. Yeah. And I think this is what happens. Nobody knows what to say to someone, yeah, whether it's a mother or a son or a father or a brother. Nobody knows what to say.
And I really do, having done this show and having talked to people who have lost people to suicide, it's really opened my eyes up to, I felt no one knows what to say to me. And no one has the right words and everyone's being awkward and stupid and I want to punch them. And I had that cloak of cancer that it was like, oh, that's such a sad tragedy. I can't imagine when you don't even have an illness.
I remember listening to your podcast, though. I can't remember who it was with. And I remember it's the one thing I took up, maybe not umbrage with, but the idea of being really annoyed at someone because they don't know what to say. I was like, that's going to happen to you, Carriet. You are going to be that person.
Oh, yeah, it has happened to me.
Yeah, but I feel like that's okay. Yeah. And also when you are going through something, what I've learned as well, don't assume someone else isn't.
No.
So you might have lost someone, but someone else might have illness in the family. They might not be able to walk. Someone else might have something.
And I think it taught me. I was coming from like a 15-year-old point of view of like suddenly no one knew what to say to me.
Yes.
And also I was angry at my dad.
But I was angry at my dad as well. But I also had all of these things in my life. And I recently met up with a girl I knew at school. I was in Canada doing a gig and she was like, oh, I'll come along. We went for a beer afterwards. And I had no idea what had been happening in her life
or a
lot of the girls in my school's life. And they hadn't lost anyone.
Yeah, yeah.
And so sometimes I think with grief, we can walk around like our scar is bigger than other people's who haven't lost.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
sure,
that's the one thing I try to be mindful of, because when I mean that no one knows what to say, I mean that in a, like, I don't have the answers.
Yeah.
And I don't know if what
don't
to say to
are.
Me is
yeah, yeah.
is the right thing to yeah. say to someone else.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it to always be wary that what I've learned from my article, because growing up, when I found out that my dad had taken his own life, I didn't feel like my father was dead. I felt like he had abandoned the family.
Mm.
And I used to associate more with girls whose fathers had fecked off.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how I thought of suicide then. And when I say then, I really mean up till a few years ago.
Yeah.
So it's been quite a long journey. And also to let that go. One big light bulb moment that came was I was reading this book and it was all about like your story. So, you know, we all go around with our story. So, for example, I am like this because of this. And the thing is, when I was a child, this happened and that's why I'm like that. And it was all about what would you do if you let your story go?
Mm.
And I was like, no, I can't let my story go. Because the thing is, I am who I am despite my dad's death.
Yeah.
And it also said, why not now paint the positives of that?
Yeah, yeah.
And I'd never, for me, that was sacrilegious to paint the positives of my father dying.
Yeah.
But I'd sat down for this exercise, like, fine, I'll do it. It's part of the exercise of the book. And I sat down and wrote out the positives of my dad taking his own life, but also just not being around growing up.
Yeah.
And I was able to see that, like, oh, I can connect with women. Like, I love women. I love women so much, even the knobheads. I bloody love women. I also got to be the funniest person in my family. Mm. If he was alive, he would have been the funniest person. Also, he probably would have been in charge.
Yeah.
I assume women are in charge all the time.
Yeah.
It's helped me in my career, in my life. I also have grown up since the age of 3 with a sort of natural empathy, which I don't know if I would have. Also, a sort of, since a teenage era, know that I will never take my own life because I would never do that to my family, knowing what it's like to be left behind. There's all these, and they're all positives, and it feels weird to take a positive away from a tragedy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it was literally something changed in me, literally that day after, say, maybe 27 years. Something changed in me that day.
I think it's so important. I've talked about that a lot in the show that, you know, with having a child, there's now this whole movement of, you know, if you have a child, you don't have to be miraculously happy. You know, you can be sad. Mm. That's okay. And we're now encompassing the whole of birth. And we're like, look, it's all of those things. It's lots of emotion. And that's how I feel about this podcast and death. I feel like yes, obviously there's all this shit, but there's all this positive stuff. And it, everyone feels guilty about admitting that. But like me and my mum and brother talk about a lot of like, yeah, a lot of positive stuff. Like my mum went to university.
Yes.
Like she left school at 15.
And this is not us being hippy-dippy happy at all.
It's just true.
It's just a part of your process to help you out of something. So for me, doing that helped me out of... It was more a release. I watched this article and it was this American pastor and, you know, she was one of those cool pastors who had tattoos and you're like, okay.
I've seen that.
Okay, yeah. Probably because I posted it on my Facebook the other day. But it was all about forgiveness. And the biggest thing that happened with me is to genuinely have forgiven my father. Now, some people will say, you don't need to forgive him. He took his own life. He was he wasn't well. There was no element of you shouldn't have been angry with him in the first place.
But that is
sometimes what people feel. And I understand that as well. But for me, I was angry. And I was angry on behalf of my mother. You know, she was a 33-year-old with two baby kids. And I always felt like something about that, if I had been worth enough, should have clicked in and made you go, oh, no, I can't do this. Rather than all the things I've learned about like it being a moment of madness in that day or his self-esteem versus a feeling of, do I have any self-worth or value here? Or would I be more value if I wasn't here?
Yeah.
And also just being a parent and, you know, postnatal depression in men, which isn't talked about a lot either. Their feeling of having to provide, or can I do this? But forgiveness, this American pastor talks about forgiveness as, because a lot of people feel, if I forgive something that has happened to me, so if someone has done something wrong to me, this could be a way a girl or a boy broke up with you. This will be the way the teleservices person, when you rang up to cancel your phone contract, treated you. If I forgive them, I am allowing that behaviour to be an okay way to treat me.
Mm.
And I think a lot of us feel like that. And I definitely felt, I was like, if I forgive my father, I am saying that you taking me for granted, which is what I thought happened, is okay.
Yeah.
And actually what she says about forgiveness is, it's not that. It's that you are releasing the chain that attaches you to that behaviour, and you're saying, that's not me. And I can't tell anyone to do that. You can only decide to do that yourself.
Mm.
But God, it's honestly like breathing when you didn't know you've a third lung.
Yeah,
and that's kind
of
how I felt the last year. I felt like I've been given a third lung to breathe. And it has been quite amazing. And there's been moments like today, randomly, I think the knock-on effect of doing that other show.
Oh, of course, and you today, know you're going to have to talk about it. I mean,
yeah,
God.
But no, it wasn't
you know,
that. It was interesting, I think, what happens a lot with grief. It was almost like, I was grand. And today I got a couch delivered. And I put so much energy into this couch. I never measure things before I order them, but I properly measured all of this
got
couch.
Got it sorted.
And my house is really... I live on my own. I've got my own, like my own stuff. I can see my achievements in the appliances that I bought. I'm like, oh, that's that panel show I didn't enjoy, but there's a nice fridge. I kind of see, and I got this new L-shaped couch, which was, I don't have a dining room, so people can sit around it. All my friends, when Cariad comes over, she can be sat there and I can be sat over there. And it came in and these three lovely guys delivered it from John Lewis, and it's just too bulky for the room.
No.
And it's custom made and it took 8 weeks to arrive. And honestly, I didn't really, I teared up a little bit just there, but I didn't cry.
Yeah.
I teared up doing that Irish show, but I didn't cry. And the John Lewis couch came in and I went, bye lads, oh, lovely to see you. And one of them asked for a selfie. I was like, grand, yeah, no problem. Did a little selfie, went, oh yeah, made a little joke on the way out. All the best lads, close the door. And I went in and I cried. And I was like, this couch is too bulky. It's the right length, it's the right width, but it's too bulky and it makes my other items look ridiculous. And it wasn't about
couch. It's not about the couch, babes.
Babe, that's not about the couch. It was, I think, realising that this was coming. Because you and I had talked about doing this podcast since you started it. And I remember when you asked me first, I thought maybe Cariad's podcast would be a good, safe place to start about suicide, talk about suicide. But then I knew if I just started without having my family's permission, in a sense.
Of course, yeah, it's very, very sensitive.
But also the right words, given how much, I do a lot of A, B and C, so apologies if anyone's listening and going, is she a maths teacher or a comedian? Come on. A, it helps my head form thoughts. it's suicide and people just don't talk about it enough because, again, we don't know what to say. But B, we didn't talk about it in my family. So for me to talk publicly about something before talked sort of privately is still maybe a little bit odd. And they're getting to know me as an adult, a lot of my aunties and stuff like that.
Because a lot of people said that to my mum of like, well, how do you feel about her doing the show? And my mum's always been very like, well, you know, like, yeah, it's up to her really. But we did talk about it a lot. But obviously it's a very different situation. Mm. But it was talked about almost to the point where 1 year we had to go, we need to stop talking about this. Like 1 year it was like, my mum was like, enough, like up till three, talking about the, you know, death and life and what it means and why it happens. And my mum was like, can we just have a Christmas where we don't have to do this? Because we would like rake over everything.
See, this is the thing with suicide, it clams everyone up.
Yeah, of course, it's so different. It's so different.
It's almost like, and I remember one time, this is growing up in Catholic Ireland, there was like suicide was only decriminalised in 1989.
Wow.
So that was 2 years after my dad died.
God.
And people still say committed suicide, but you can only commit a crime. Yeah. And so that, even the language around it is, it's a crime. And there was a time where, this is classic Ireland, there was a time in Irish history where if you attempted suicide, you were punished by hanging. Yep, that's Ireland for you folks. That's the country we're living in. And so technically, in a very Catholic country, it is a mortal sin to take your own life because the idea is Jesus has given you life and you've thrown it back in his face in some way. And like all these things with guilt and Catholicism, it permeates society, it permeates your cells, what make you up without you even knowing it, because it's part
in
of
your
society.
DNA,
yeah, and
it?
A lot of the people who got in touch with me whose mothers took their own life back in, say, the 40s and 50s, a lot of kind of older people who got in touch said that everyone, the priest would refuse to write those things on death certificates because then they weren't going to heaven. Or would you be even be able to be buried in a Catholic graveyard?
Yeah.
So all these things have hangovers in terms of people talking about them. And also, I think, I know for my mother, it was always like, ugh, if I say it, I already know the reaction they're going to get. So I'm just going to say he died tragically and moved on.
Mm.
And now, also not telling us, I can totally understand, because still there's very little chat about what to tell kids. But now we know, and I've read a lot about this with child psychology, the best thing you can do is tell a child the truth in any way possible.
I know,
so
I've read so much about that.
Don't lie to children because it's not a lie.
Yeah.
By the way, it's not, my mother didn't lie to us, she just couldn't tell us what happened.
Of course.
But then later on, as a teenager, early teenager, late child, you view it back as a lie.
Yeah,
and then it starts to make you question reality and what's real and what's not. And now they say, even if it's explaining suicide to kids, you do it in a very simple term and they will know that that's what happened and they will move on.
Having spoken to Julia Samuels from Child Bereavement UK and then Shelley Gilbert from Grief Encounter, so much of it started up after my dad died in 1988.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember talking to them and now the way it's talked about, the way they understand it, like I think if you were around before then, it's almost like it's the same as the 50s in a way. Like obviously I was told and it was explained, but like the charities that are available now, I think it's just, I'm so happy to hear what's happening now.
But the problem is that you go to those charities when it happens.
Yes.
And the more you chat about it on comedy podcasts, I know I haven't done many gags here, lads, so don't worry, I'll put them in at the end.
I mean, it's not a comedy podcast.
We can pepper them through later on. But the problem is that in society, we need to talk about it before it happens.
Yeah.
So there's no point, not no point, at all. That's not what I'm saying. But you go to those when you need them. But
I guess at least they're there because they weren't there when I was a teenager. And when they were saying the things they offer, like taking kids away for a weekend, would just hang out with other kids who've also lost people.
Yeah.
And I just thought, God, to be around a group of teenagers and not feel like I'm weird, there's something wrong with me, my family's strange, that like something really weird happened to us that no one else understands. I just think because grief makes you feel isolated, but of course you're right to talk about,
I think,
it so that
any
people
form
know
of
about
child
it.
Counseling though as well, because what about things like divorce or separation, those things can have massive effects on kids because they're forms of grief as well, and I think they're forms of loss. And maybe I just believe in therapy and getting kids into counselling and talking therapy as much as you can before anything happens. Mm. It's like, don't give them vegetable soup when they're sick. Give them vegetables before to stop them getting sick.
When did you start going to therapy then?
Probably, I think I've tried everything. So I've tried counselling, CBT, the pills, the not the pills, the therapists, crystal healers, which I will highly recommend.
We
love a crystal
love
healer.
It. Why not?
We're two white ladies living in London doing comedy. Of course we love a crystal healer.
Thank you, Lou Sanders.
Big shout out to Lou Sanders, my fellow crystal healer lady. So, yeah, I've tried everything, but it's
but
like
dating. Did you
wait
till you were in your 20s? Did it kind of take, like, because when you were in like, you didn't have anything when you were in Ireland?
When I was in Ireland, at university, there was some free counselling on campus. And my boyfriend at the time said, maybe you should go to counselling. I was like, why? Don't be stupid, why? And he's like, you just seem angry sometimes. I don't angry, you're madness. So he maybe thought it might be a good idea. So at that stage I started. And again, when you're angry and going in, if you go because someone recommends you to go,
it
doesn't always have the effect. I think what's happened to me now, especially this last year, is I am so open to letting go of me as a sad person, as so open to being having a bright future.
Yeah.
And that only comes with small daily little things you do.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
My therapist, we got into something very recently, which really sort of surprised me. Didn't surprise me in a way, as ever with therapy. I was like, oh yeah, I sort of knew that. And it was this thing of like, I think my whole therapy journey has been trying to let go of 15-year-old me. And I find that that's another loss. It feels like a death. Everything to me feels like anything that goes is like, you've died. When people leave suddenly, I feel like, I feel it painfully. I'm like, I'm so bad at saying goodbye to people because in my head, like, could be the last time, could be the last time. But she was saying, you know, letting that person go, again, like you said, gives you this freedom. But what I found so much was like, it felt like grieving him all over again, like letting go of the angry person who's bullshit and
do you feel like, and this is what I was saying about earlier about letting go of your story, do you feel like if you let go of 15-year-old you, then your dad's gone?
Yeah, what, because I was brought up, interesting, the self-help weird shit they were into, they used to always say everything's a narrative, Carrie, that's just your story. I literally was brought up with that, so it's not it's not so much like, oh, like the girl whose dad died, but it's like, if I let go of him, I have to admit he's gone. 50 on me, I have to admit he's dead.
So this is what happened with me this year. I honestly have felt like the ghost of my dad has always been around, for better or for worse.
Yeah.
And in some way, and I've hated him quite a lot of the time. And since November, since I wrote the article, the ghost is gone. You know, in Drop Dead Fred.
Yeah.
So for those of you who don't know Drop Dead Fred, it's this girl has a really creepy, this is not why I remember my dad, because I'm angry at him. they've got a really creepy, invisible friend who, when she takes her antidepressants, he goes, but then eventually she doesn't need him anymore.
Mm.
And it's it's that same thing of not totally realizing you don't need Santa Claus anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And in some way, like, that part of me will always be there, but he's gone now.
Yeah.
And there's no ghosty bit. I suppose I buried him.
Mm.
And
let go of that part of your grief and moved into something else.
I didn't get to go to the funeral. I was a kid, so I'd never seen him go anywhere. And in terms of people's mental health, it's really important that you see a body go away.
Yeah, definitely.
It is really important that you see a body buried, and that is for the psychology of humans. That person is physically gone.
Yeah. Oh,
someone, and I do truly believe, I'm quite a spiritual person, I'm not a holy person, but I believe that whatever we like to call a ghost or an energy of someone, whether it's religious or you're an atheist, the people you're around make up who you are.
Mm.
You are a massive part of my life. You will make little bits of my personality as we go along. And so your parents are your first two big parts of who you are.
Yeah, yeah.
Even their absence is makes you there.
Massive.
So that is a ghost inside in you in some way, whether
yeah.
your mind decides to think they're up in the window or they're hiding in the shelf or they're in the sky. That person is part of you.
Mm.
But the idea of then really making it a ghost, I think then to let go of that, and when I let go of the anger and had to forgive my dad and then write that article, that it was no longer my secret thing. It was now a public thing to go, and my family all talked about it, and we had the funeral in a sense.
Yeah.
I, for the first time ever, my aunts and uncles in, and we're very close family, for the first time ever spoke to me about my dad
wow.
in 30 years. And they did it with such love and happiness. And what I also realised was they were all younger than me when
yeah.
it happened. And I always thought of them as adults, and I thought of my dad as an adult. And a big part of my coming to understanding was me now nearly being his age.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't feel
yeah,
that
like
a grown up.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, you for me are a baby who has a baby. I'm like, yeah. what? Carriette is a baby, but she's a baby herself.
That's how I feel.
That's how I feel. And
like,
so
why,
for me, you have
this.
And everyone, I think, has an idea of their parents when they look back at their parents. They see them almost in old fashioned clothes with old fashioned haircuts because
yeah.
they're adults, and you don't realize that they're all still kids in a way as well.
Yeah.
And we all, I don't think any of us ever totally shake off that idea that we're not kids in a way, or just like working our way. No one can work their way through the world for you.
And
you
that,
find out
that is growing
path.
Up. Like
yeah.
that's what I've realised. Growing up is realising no one's a grown up.
I wonder for you is a little bit of not letting go of your 15-year-old self. And maybe that's what's happened with me in this last year. Me not being an angry kid at my dad, or me not being a kid at my dad's funeral anymore,
mm.
and talking to people who are grieving in front of me now for the first time, like my uncle and stuff, who's never got to talk about my dad,
yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm the adult in the situation, that maybe you have to now be, you're not 15 anymore,
yeah,
you have to be an
yeah.
adult.
But that's what the whole therapy thing has been,
mm.
is letting go of her,
mm.
and letting go of my dad.
Yeah.
And I realise, again, thanks to therapy, praise be.
Big shout out to therapy across the UK.
Big shout out to therapy. That if you listen to the podcast at the beginning, I say constantly, when I was 50, my dad died. My
mm.
dad died. And I literally don't say he's dead.
Yeah.
I don't say it until
he's
very
gone.
Recently, because I realised died. And my therapist says it's quite an active word. It sounds like
mm.
someone's still doing it. They're dying.
Yeah.
You know, they're dying, man. Like, they're on it. He's doing it. That's
yeah.
what's happening. And I have had to, yeah, I'd say, like, since having a baby, probably, that's for me been the big shift, because it was
mm.
like, oh, I've got a baby. I can't be 15-year-old Carriette. Like,
yeah.
look what's happening. Like, I'm married and I'm,
yeah.
you know, with a man,
tiny
and I've had
life.
A baby. So
yeah.
I'm definitely not that person anymore. And that was a really painful, like, it felt like ripping apart rather than, like you said, like, I feel like maybe some people going like, oh, right, I've, you know, I moved into this part of my life. I was like, because that teenage life meant he was still there. And I really had to accept he's dead. And I think I honestly probably about maybe 3 or 4 months ago, it was the first time she made me say in therapy, I had to go, my dad's dead.
Mm.
And I, yeah, was like bawling my eyes out. And I've been practicing it and saying it and being like, yeah, okay. And also doing the show.
It's very emotional going into, if you're to look at your life as a book, going into the next chapter
yes,
and closing a chapter
yes,
on something.
So
and so
massive.
Many of these metaphorical words might seem, again, quite hippy-dippy, but they're so helpful for your head to get around an idea. But to end something,
yeah.
like to really like, I just realised recently, I had a big relationship a couple of years ago that broke my heart, and I'm sure I broke his heart. And it, we were angry with each other for a while, and then we both moved on in the last year and a half, particularly. We both really moved on. And all that was left between us now is the love for each other, but no romance and no anger. And I got really emotional over that, because even though it was happy, that's gone now. You're almost a little bit sad for your old self that they didn't know it was coming. Like, if you could go back in a time machine and tell yourself it's going to be fine, you're like, I'll never let go of that scar. But actually to do that is emotional, even though you know it's positive. In it, like, it's a bit like, you know, when you have to like reset a bone. But it's sore, but it will grow back stronger.
I think that once you've had grief, I find losses are very tricky because they bring me back to grief. So anything, any lot, like a loss, if I don't, if I'm not speaking to a friend as much as you, so I feel that I get this pain of like,
do you know, it reminds me of death. I don't get that. Because I think we grew up around death. Growing up, we were really blasé. We were growing up around death. And in Ireland, despite having an unhealthy attitude to suicide, we have a very... So in Ireland, we go to every funeral, even the people we don't know. I remember when I first came to London, I went to drama school, and a guy in my year, his dad died. And I said, right, lads, will you get a minibus together to go up north to go to Ben's dad's funeral? And everyone was like, they looked at me like I said, do you want to do a contemporary dance around the coffin? Because they were like, we don't know him. And I'm like, but we know Ben. Of course we'll all go. And in Ireland, they leave a body out. I have been to children's funerals. I have been to elderly people's funerals. I have seen every type of body laid out. My granny died and we all sat around her eating sandwiches and everyone's like, oh, doesn't she look really well? And I was like, well, she looked better. And everyone had a laugh. We're like, ah. No, but seriously, she's done well.
My favourite, we did a live episode with Gráinne Maguire, Dolly Alderton and Áirithe Shaw. And my absolute favourite moment was when Áirithe turned to Gráinne and was like, oh yeah, I heard this funny rumour that like Irish people leave the body out, or like you might have it in the pub. And Gráinne went, And you could see that Áirithe thought it was like a kind of sort of like mean thing people said about Irish people. And Gráinne was like,
No, that's it. Do you know what? I was just talking about this on Sunday because my sister's boyfriend is Indian and he's never been to a funeral. And we find that hilarious. And myself and Sinead, because we grew up with like a dead parent, or like our dad was a ghost, like that was his job. And sometimes we'd make a joke out of it, like, what's your dad do? It's like, oh, he's a ghost. We have a very dark sense of humour that some people get really uncomfortable around. Like if there was a creak in the house, sometimes we'd say to our flatmate when we lived with her, we were like, oh, there's daddy trying to close the door, he better close it. And she'd be like, oh my God, guys, that's so dark. But we'd laugh our heads off.
Of course,
And that part of Irish life and death and joking about it is just so in our bones. But also then if you're a child who has had death, it's just a really... it's just a really taken for granted thing. Also, what's funny is that I think myself and my sister have a real panic about getting everything done fast and getting as much things done as possible, even with work, because people are always like, well, you could be dead tomorrow. And we're like, yeah, no, we know, so we better get it done. What if you die tomorrow and you haven't done all the 7 projects you'd like to do?
That's
so we don't go on holidays.
I have that.
You don't, like, just
you
quick.
You could die. And like, I remember friends at uni being like, oh, well, like, I'll probably get cancer and die. Who cares? And I'd be like, but you actually probably really will. So like, why are we all sitting here dicking around? Like, this is not okay. I think the way it affects you is so...
we rarely live in the present, myself and my sister. We live in the past or the future all the time. Being like, just in case. But that's something I'm trying to learn to do.
Oh, it's hard.
Now.
It's really hard. I think whatever your life experiences is, it's hard to stay there. But it's interesting that you said, and I do find that interesting about Ireland, that there is, like, Gráinne was talking about it, like, you know, she's been to so many funerals, she's seen so many dead bodies. But then the juxtaposition of that and suicide must have been hard growing up to be like, yeah, death's everywhere, we're cool with it, but not this thing over here.
I always remember my mother saying, and again, I don't want to, this is not about her, so you don't want to tell someone else's story, but I always remember part of her, she's never held his death against him, like I did. And I always, I really, my trigger, you know, when you're like, if someone leaves you for too long, you're like, it could be, I have the opposite. I have a thing about being taken for granted or not appreciated, which all I know comes from my dad's death, that I've only had to let go. And it would happen with boyfriends or friends. If I felt like they were taking me for granted, because in my head, that's what Daddy did with myself and Sinead's life. Because if you read the article I wrote, and I don't want to double up on artistic forms here or force you to go and do a kind of like...
article. Do read it.
But I also don't want to kind of get you to like double up and do homework alongside the podcast. But one of the things was that my dad didn't mention us in his letter. And that has been the thing that's haunted me my whole life. Because I'm like, in my head, I was like, oh, we weren't worth your pen scribbling a few more letters for 10 more seconds.
Mm.
And for me, that has haunted me my whole life, that I wasn't worth another bit of writing. And Sinead, who's my everything, wasn't worth it. Even he could have, Sinead didn't even get to know you. You could have written down her name. Like that was always my biggest scar.
Mm.
And what happened was, again, this is in the article, randomly, it was Christmas, and my mother rang me up and was like, you're never going to believe what's happened. I'm like, what? And she was like, these people he used to work for at the veterinary surgery basically found a box of his stuff. They cleared his desk and put all his stuff after he died and put all his stuff in a box. And they just thrown it into a filing cabinet, this box, or told it into a filing area. And then 28 years later, rang her up and were like, do you want this box or will you throw it in the bin? And honestly, these shits were just, and this is like the week before Christmas to do this to Mammy. And Mammy's like, well, you could send it over. Right, we'll send it over. And they dropped it out after they'd kept it for that long and never thought that his wife might want
his stuff.
And when we opened the box, there was like obviously all his veterinary notes and all those sort of things. But in it were all these photos. And I, like growing up, I was obsessed with photos of him.
Mm.
I just looked at every single photo because I was trying to work out. And even then when I became a teenager and learned about how he died, I was trying to look in these photos to see, could I see sadness in his eyes? Is there a clue the moment when he might have gotten sick or what had happened? And he had a back injury and was in quite a lot of pain quite a lot of the time. But that's almost like, that was probably the straw that quite literally broke his back. But like the sadness was in him and it probably always been in him. When we opened this box and Mammy waited for us to come home and we opened this, and it was just this like, we were just like three little women looking into this shitty 1980s style brown.
Yeah.
Like one of those boxes you always see like when a bank closes down, people leaving with a little office desk and a little plant in them boxes. Like this was Aladdin's cave, and in the box were all these photos, and they were nearly all of me. And he had died in his workplace and taken an overdose there. And I'd been the, you know, one of the last things he'd been looking at. And in my head, and someone got in touch with me recently and said that her dad had left them when they were kids and had never bothered to get in touch much or anything like that. And years later, after her dad had died, his other wife came and told her that his whole life he had carried around a picture of her in her wallet. And she always said, she was like, God, I don't know how my life or who I would have become if I'd known he'd cared to have a photo of me.
Yeah.
And for me, that was part, I didn't totally take it in immediately, but it slowly seeped in. Like these photos I'd never seen, and I had seen every single photo.
Yeah.
I remember one album he had from before he'd met Mammy. And I didn't know what a ladyboy was when I was a kid. And he had been a vet out in Australia. And there was this one photo of him with a group of his pals and a ladyboy on his lap. And I thought she was the most beautiful woman I had ever seen. But like such an exotic beauty.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, does Mammy know he ever saw this exotic beauty? Maybe she could have been my mother in another life. And like only years later, I went back and looked at the photo. I was like, oh my God, there's that beautiful, oh, it's a ladyboy. She clearly was in Bangkok. And so that had kind of meant everything to me. But why I wrote the article is not a lot of people get that. Like that was sort of like quite a filmic, magical little bit of closure. And I know most of what people, I can pretty much assume with most of the topic of suicide, it's the why.
Mm.
And nobody will ever get that why. They'll never really know the why or what incident or what level of sadness pushed you but not someone else. And in a way, I felt like we got this message from a grave, and I felt so blessed and honoured to get this weird, have this weird thing happen.
I
remember once when I was in my second year of Lambda, which is drama school in London, I didn't have a TV in our house, and they had this, I just saw randomly the Metro newspaper over lunchtime that that night there was going to be a documentary about suicide on these kids who'd lost their father. And I couldn't tell anyone why I wanted to watch it, but I asked if there was any way, weirdly. I asked my friend, I was like, oh, there's this random show on tonight. Can I go back to your house and watch it? And they were like, yeah, you can come round to our house. And I remember going back to their house and going, oh, guys, you don't need to talk to me. I'll just watch it privately. Like, it's literally this like shitty thing I want to watch. It's for a character I'm trying to develop, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, okay, well, I'll just be upstairs making tea. I'm like, yeah, grand. Because I didn't want them to sit. And I stared at this BBC documentary about these kids because I had not seen or heard another story. Yeah. There were no podcasts then.
I know, this is like, there's nothing.
There was no. But I didn't know how to hear someone else speaking about suicide.
Yeah.
It's just nowhere to be seen and nowhere to be talked about. And I needed to know that someone else felt angry and felt okay, and felt, because my only experience of how people dealt with suicide was my mother's, and she, when we talk about looking into the coffin and seeing a body, she will always say that when she looked into the coffin at my dad, she saw the face of the man she married, and all of his stress lines were gone, and he just seemed happy. And she was like, that's what he needed to do, or that's him, rather than he'd sort of not seemed so tired and sad and stressed. And maybe she hadn't known how much he had been that. And with the, I remember looking at this TV being like, oh God, like drinking every bit because you don't know when someone's going to talk about it again. There was no like, this wasn't that long ago. It was probably 10 years ago, but there was no videoing the TV. And even if there had been, I still don't know how to do it.
I know, but people forget like it was this barren wasteland. I remember watching a programme about comedy that Ruby Wax did about like funny women. And she interviewed Dawn French, and suddenly they started talking about the fact that their dads were dead. And
I know,
you know
the one you're talking about, because I saw that too. And also, can I just say, nearly every woman in comedy's dad is dead.
Yes, I know, there's so many of us.
It's ridiculous.
My mum says every week, oh, is it another dead dad? You've got so many comedians and their dead dads. I'm like, yes, mother. But I remember sitting on the sofa in my living room and I froze because I was like, oh, they're talking about it like it's normal, like it's a, just a normal thing, and they're laughing, and they were both sort of laughing and telling stories, and, you know, it was obviously sad, but I meant, you know, that was such a thing for me. I was like, oh, happens to other people. And these people also still want to be funny and still are making jokes about it.
And they are, and no crack is lost.
But yeah, and I felt like, I just felt connected. And that was such an inspiration for this show as well, of like going, I, like you said, I remember drinking it in and thinking, I wish I could watch that again, but I can't because we live in the past. And I was like, that's it, it's gone. But just freezing, thinking, taking everything they're saying, remember what they're saying, and then just going, oh, that felt amazing that I wasn't alone. For a second, I wasn't alone. I wasn't weird.
It is an interesting thing, that element of either gone dads or dead dads in comedy with women, because I wonder, is there something, and again, this is looking at the positive, is it that if you're then left in a house that becomes a matriarchy, you have an ownership of your voice. You are the probably going to be the funniest person in the family, and you have to help your parent be in charge. And that being in charge then means when you get up in front of people to talk or to be funny, you're not used to being not the one in charge.
I don't know what I I think obviously every family's different. Like my mum, God, she'd kill me for this, and she does listen. It's not that she she didn't get happier when my dad died, but like we've said, I've said this before, there was more air in that house because he was a very big personality and he was not always happy. And there seemed to be this kind of weird, like, I think my mum had this kind of like, the worst things fucking happened, so might as well just like start enjoying ourselves. And I think that was hard for other people perhaps to see us kind of being like, well, we're gonna just
live.
Laugh,
but you
and
see,
live.
A lot of the thing what, like, what death can teach you to do is to bloody live. And to not, there's a difference between being alive, and this is what I think happens a lot with depression, is that, you know, do you know what it is? It's very easy to live miserably for a very long time, and it's very easy to live sadly for a very long time, until you get bored of it. Because everyone does, no, people don't generally mind being miserable or sad. Mm. People really mind being bored.
I
think you have to get bored of your misery.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's where I got to. I was so bored of having these issues, with even with men as a result of my dad, these bloody daddy issues. It was so boring to me that I decided something had to change.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was very happy to be miserable. And when you're miserable, you can stay alive for a very long time without living.
Yeah, and I was very happy to stay angry because angry made me it made me feel alive.
Yeah, and powerful. And there's a power in anger.
Yeah, and there was no power. And I remember vividly being at school and a teacher trying to say, like, are you okay? And I thought, I'm going to cry, but if I get angry, I won't.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, we'll get angry then. And then I turned, fuck you, what the fuck do you know? And it just made me go, oh, great. It means I can get out of a situation. I don't have to explain myself. I don't have to be, they don't get it, tap into what I'm actually feeling. And it just was like, oh, because I felt so scared when anyone got near it. I was like, I don't know how, if I open this door, what the fuck's going to happen, basically.
I think I didn't use anger, even though I was very angry. I think I used jokes.
Oh, yeah. No,
because I think I knew my... I knew how sad my mother was and I hated that. And I knew that I could make her happy.
Yeah.
But also, if I was making other people laugh, I seemed okay.
Yeah.
And
that
was her biggest worry. Her biggest worry wasn't her own sadness. Her biggest worry were like, are the girls okay? Because what do you bloody do? Like, she had to just like feed us, never mind all the other stuff.
Yeah.
And if I seem happy or okay, and I always remember when she sat down and told us, that was clearly like a massive day for her.
Oh, God.
And I always remember from that moment, I was like, I am going to protect these two children. Like, I got totally Liam Neeson and Taken. I was like, I have a very specific set of skills, and that is to make people laugh. And I'm going to so determinedly make people laugh that my mother will never know if anything's wrong with me.
Mm.
And I remember she was out in the car talking to our neighbour. Like, they both sat into the car by the gate, so clearly not wanting to be in the house where we could listen in. And she was clearly telling my neighbour that she told the girls after all these years. Because I think a lot of people around us now didn't know when or if we knew or what to say. Because they didn't know if we knew.
Mm.
And I remember seeing that she was out in the car and deciding I was going to skip to the car to ask her if we were having dinner or a cup of tea, some silly thing.
Yeah.
And then I went, hi, Claire. And then I decided to skip back. And I was like, that woman will never know I'm not okay because that'll break her heart. But what that did in my mind.
How did that then affect you?
Oh, like, I just kept it all inside.
Yeah.
And from then on, I made a pattern of literally. So many of my friends after the article had, I didn't know you never told me about that with your dad. Mm. And these are close friends.
Yeah, I didn't know. Yeah. I remember asking you. Remember we were in LA?
Yes.
And somebody was asking, Brett was asking me about, he didn't know that my dad had died, which I was like,
yes, I remember.
How do you not know?
Brett, we were all in the car together and Brett was eating loads of pepperami for protein to keep himself buff. Yeah.
Disgusting. And I was like, oh yeah, my dad died. And then he said something like, oh, like that he must have known your dad was dead, I think. And I was and because I'm so...
Brett was one of the first pals I told, and I don't know why. I think Brett, Brett Goldstein, big shout out to our friend Brett Goldstein, but Brett doesn't do small chat. Brett doesn't do small chat, he'll go, how'd your dad die, straight away.
I remember asking you because I'm so into asking people about death, and I remember being, I didn't know, like, and you didn't answer, and I remember just thinking... and you were so good at changing the subject that I don't think till I got home.
Do you know, I don't remember that at all.
Yeah, I remember
us being in the car. I don't remember changing the subject because I did that all the time.
It was incredible. Like, because I'm somebody who, I love talking about it, I'm ready to go there. So when I found out and you said, my dad said, I was like, oh, well, this is a great chat we can have. Mm-hmm. And then the subject, and I remember going home and thinking, I didn't know that, hang on, she didn't. I just still don't know.
Yeah.
And which is so rare for me because I'm always like, I'm same as Brett. I can't do this. Let's get to the meat. What's
happening.
Match.
You don't understand, Carriad. How good I am at that.
But you obviously, like you said, had got incredibly good at
changing the subject. Yes, because I honestly, the words wouldn't come out of my neck.
Yeah, of course.
I didn't. It was like some, even no matter how, and that was only like, 3-4 years ago?
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago. Yeah, yeah.
It was like something in my childhood brain go, we keep that secret. And so that stays in there. And even a big part of like writing that article, a big scary part was the fact that I, as a public figure, I talk about myself like I'm Nelson Mandela.
No, but you are.
I'm in the public eye, but my family aren't and they haven't decided. Yet here I am.
Yeah,
going through the shop, kicking over all the glass vases that we've kept for so long.
Yeah, and it's hard. I have
on my own.
I mean, I'm not nearly as a public figure as you are. But I
no, Carrie, you are more of a public figure than me. Please accept that you're more of a public figure.
I'm bigger
than
Nelson Mandela, but not as big as you. but I really know that feeling of being like the way I process things is out loud and in public and through comedy and through talking in front of an audience. And I don't know if you had this of thinking, oh shit, I wish I didn't have to now go and talk about my dad's death, because it would be much easier for everybody if I packed away those glass vases. But I know me, I know I've got to do this. Mm. And luckily my family have been okay about it, but I mean, we've talked about this before, of like, there's definitely days I'm like, what have I done? Why did I go and kick all those glasses?
Yeah.
It seemed like I really needed to, but...
I don't regret it lately.
Mm.
I did a little bit at the start, just because of the amount of people who'd
understandably
go up to mammy. Not me. Yeah. Not, I didn't care about me. It was it was my mother, you know, people coming up to her a lot about something that's just so sad for her. And that's not something
and
she likes.
A long time ago.
Exactly. But what came out of it was three men who were best friends with Daddy when he was at university have all gotten in touch from around the world. And one of them got in touch with my agent and they were like, we have photos of your dad from the 70s when we went to Chicago.
That's the magic.
And these three men... I felt a bit like in Mamma Mia, you know, the way there's these three different men. She's not sure which her dad is. Myself and my sister have sort of met up with them for tea. One of them came over from Australia. One of them came over from England. Another one was over visiting his daughter who lives in London. And I'm staring at these men who are the exact same age as my dad, who are all also vets. I don't mean Vietnam, I mean horses and cows. And I'm looking at them going, somewhere in you is what my dad would be like some version of you. And they all have good senses of humour and stuff. And it's been quite ghostly. And so they all had a big night where they got back together and met up in my mum's house. And luckily I wasn't able to go home for it, because I think if I'd been there, it would have been about me and the article, and I look really like my dad. But I think without him there, they could just sort of remember. Because at the time as well, when something happens, I think everyone thinks of the kids in the immediately family first. But what I've sort of realised since we've all started talking about it was my uncle lost his pal, and he was only 26 when it happened. My aunties lost their brother-in-law. Some neighbours lost their neighbour that they pop into for a pint. Like, all these people who hadn't been able to deal with their grief and their version of, could I have, did I miss something? Did I notice something?
They were adults at that time. It's a very different.
And a lot of people held on to some guilt. There was one man I know who got very upset. He'd never said it to Mammy, and she's known him for like 30 years, but he just got very upset because he just, and this is only since the article came out, he was like, Helen, I'm so sorry. I was the one who found Brian, and I tried to revive him, but I couldn't bring him back. Oh, and I just felt so sorry for that man, because when would it have been his time to grieve?
Yeah.
Like, when is it the priority was us and the, but when would his bit, when he got to say that, he didn't, where is the platform or the place where, and that's why I think therapy, that, and not everyone can afford therapy. That's why these podcasts are important. That's why books are important, because books tend to be a tenner. Therapy can be £100 a session. And very few people, I am honoured to work in a job that gives me enough money that I can go and ask someone to pay to listen to my problems. But that's where, as a society, at least if we chat more, a big thing is, and I know I'm jumping around here a lot, but a big thing I've found is so many people are afraid to talk to anyone because they think someone will get upset.
Mm.
But if you don't get upset, living in a state of almost upset, if you don't talk to your wife because you think telling her that you are down and don't feel like living anymore is upsetting and will upset her, you will live in a state of upsettedness, which is like living with your shoulders up around your ears with stress, and you will get sicker and more unwell. If you get upset, then you can start to work to get better. If you never get upset or upset someone, you're going to stay in that paralysis and that numb state for a very long time, and it will catch up with you in the end. And that is for women as well. And I'm only being gender specific here because of all the messages I've gotten through, because I think this happens a lot with wives and husbands in particular. Allow a space where your husband can get upset, and where if they tell you that they don't want to live or they're really struggling, that is not a comment on your worth as a wife or a girlfriend or a partner. That is not a comment on how much they think of your children or the value of their family. It's just that something inside's broken and needs fixing. And that's the one thing our mental health services are not going to get any better anytime soon. There is no magic money tree, as Theresa May would say, to fix the system, to get therapy and that. It's not coming. And that's where we all have to do the harder work, is not with a stranger in a room that we've paid £100, a bit like a prostitute, to sort of sit and have sex with us for an hour. The harder is fixing the problems in your own bedroom. And
don't get a prostitute in for that.
Don't get in. Though I have to say, apparently that's what a lot of them end up doing, is having a chat. That is where the work as a society to deal with mental health problems and the stigma around it and change has to start. And it has to start from a place of you deciding that you are worth fixing.
Or being helped. It's not just being helped.
Yeah.
But
there's a lot of chat, say, for example, there's two sides to it, I suppose. One is starting this now in young boys and young girls. And that's where, like I was saying before, getting vegetables into kids before they get sick.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with emotional language and talking therapy and teaching them how to emote.
Yeah.
My emotional language has come on so much in a year. But 3 years ago, I had no English words to tell you, a friend, in front of another friend, what had happened. I didn't have the words or the English to get it out of my neck to you. The other thing is then, if you're in a place where you're really low, being like, we need to talk more about mental health, or it's like you have a broken leg, people wouldn't judge if you have a broken leg, that you're in such a place that you don't want to pick up the phone or ring. You know, you don't want to ring your friends. You ring your friend normally once the crux of the sadness has passed.
Yeah.
You rarely actually ring someone crying and screaming, going, I want to die. People don't do that enough. And so in that moment where you feel on your own and alone, in that moment, if just, it's almost like what is, and I don't know if I have the answers at all, but a little bit of help might be, what is the, in case of emergency, break this glass, which is something my friend was talking about. He lost a friend to suicide recently. In that moment, if you can hopefully go and make yourself a cup of tea and hopefully wait that 15 minutes for a cup of tea. And if you can find not happiness, but hope, not that you're going to win the lottery tomorrow, but just hope that tomorrow might be a little bit better, or that you might get out of bed a bit earlier, or that you won't have a sense of failure tomorrow, or that if you go to bed early and tomorrow might be a little bit better. If that's what you can hold on to, then they're the sort of skills and things we need to start talking about slowly but surely. What we know the number to ring if there's a fire. We know as ladies, if you are getting attacked, shout fire, because no one will come and save you if you shout rape. We know all the little things to do in certain situations. But what about when our souls run out of juice, when we don't want to go on anymore? We don't, as a society, know our own in case of emergency break glass. And I think those are things we should start to do before it gets to that point. But even for people who are listening in who are trying to deal with their own lives in any way, start with the tiny small habits. Someone said to me about self-care. I think we all think that once you care about yourself, then you'll start looking after yourself. So once I care about myself, then maybe I'll take a shower. Or then maybe I'll start eating properly. Or do you know what? When I actually give a shit about myself, I'll start eating my vegetables. But he said to me, no, you have to start from the outside, which sounds like a vacuous thing, and work your way in. So in the mornings, get up and shower, put on your clothes, don't sit around in your pajamas, which is my favourite thing to do. Look after yourself, eat the right food, don't drink too much. Start with the outside stuff, try and get some sleep. And that will signal to your body and then to your mind that you are worth dressing and you are worth being healthy for, and you are worth getting out. And those slow, tiny messages that you are even worth vitamins and vegetables, because that's where a lot of people are, that they're not even worth that, will then go, maybe you're worth a relationship, maybe you're worth love, maybe you're worth work, maybe you're worth success, maybe you're worth all of the friendships you have, all of the love that you have in your life. Because you have to feel that you're worth those things for them to actually come
come towards you. And I think what you're saying is so, it's just life, to be in it. Super eloquent. Just life, because it's also what we say so much about grieving. So much of what I say on Twitter, but on the Griefcast Twitter, is like, you know, if you got dressed today, congratulations.
Yeah.
If you had breakfast, congratulations. If you're standing up and you're not lying down, congratulations. And I always talk about it in terms of grieving because that's my experience. But I think what you're talking about in terms of just general mental health, it's just, I think that's really nice what you said of just giving yourself an extra 15 minutes. Just like, I think...
Well, I often think depression can feel like grief, but no one's died. So you sometimes when you're really low...
Yeah, that is literally the same part of your brain that lights up. Yeah.
So you go to like, you get up in the morning and then you get dressed and you're ready to go to work and you press a button on the kettle and you go, oh shit, someone's dead. And then you look around, you're like, no one is. But yet I've still got the same feeling inside, like something is really awful. And that's, so this podcast, for example, grief doesn't necessarily have to be because of someone, and I know that might be right off topic, but grief can be in your life for a number of reasons.
Oh, yeah,
and dealing
absolutely.
With grief.
We just deal with the dead grief.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
But there's grief for all sorts of things, and I get plenty of emails from
there
people
saying...
There
are a variety of deaths
in
life that
and
you can determine.
Emails from people saying, I'm not in the club, but it helped me come to terms with this. And I'm like, oh, great. I had no idea that it would relate to you in that way because I only have my experience.
Yeah.
And I think it's been really... Yeah, really interesting to understand. My therapist said that to me as well. She was like, it's
look at us.
I know.
Exchanging therapist stories.
She was like, it's just different losses. And I'm so harsh that I'd be like, well, no one died, so why are you so upset about that?
Yeah.
Everything's measured by a death. And she was like, but losses, you just feel losses. And I was like, oh, right. Yeah. Mm. So I feel the loss of my teenage self or the loss of, you know, single me or me with before a child. Or, and then you're like, oh, I see.
And that can be a bigger loss.
Yeah. And it's just okay to feel them. Like, it's okay to feel. And to feel sad. It's all right just to feel those things.
Because I think we know that from the outside. The problem is when you feel sad, you have to feel sad. So you can say to someone else, it's okay to feel sad. But like today, I'll be honest, I just wanted to watch Love Island.
Yet instead
I felt sad and I was like, oh, today I really wanted to not be sad.
Yeah.
You know, it's that sort of thing of going, we can tell everyone like it's okay to have your period.
Yeah.
But it's really boring as well.
Oh, yeah. It's
you know,
so
it'd be
boring.
Lovely if you didn't. But what I mean is more that it's normalizing that everyone is going through it, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And here's again what I learn every bloody time. So this whole day I've been grumpy, I've been feeling weird, and I think it's a hangover from doing that show on Saturday, and I'm knowing again I was going to come to see one of my best friends, but to talk about this, and it felt so overwhelming. We have been here for how long? An hour? Who knows?
Yeah.
Cariad and Aisling speak a lot, dance a lot, move our arses a lot, laugh a lot. We do not have a concept of time. Try and get us off stage. Just try. Without a cane. But I feel lighter now than when I came in. And if there's anyone listening and you're like, no, resist. Genuinely, sitting down for an hour and this hasn't been the best gig I've ever done. There's been a very few jokes. So I did like my reference to Liam Neeson, I will say.
I thought that was great.
Yeah. But even though it, you know, we're out the other side of it and I can feel, I know tonight, I have a gig tonight. And I was worried about doing this, but when I was in that mood earlier on, I was like, I have a gig tonight. I already know I'm going to die my arse because I have to talk to Cariad about death. And
I'm so sorry.
I can already feel lighter now because I've spent probably an hour in your company not having the crack, but I know the crack's going to come back. And by crack, I mean the Irish crack. Google it, not actual. We're not here doing crack, though it might sound like we are. I know that I'll be a bit better now.
Yeah.
And
to know that you can go there and come through
And come through it.
But you have
and
to
because
go
I did get upset during this podcast And I'm out the other side of it. And I was like, I was thinking, I was like, oh God, I better get all my words together. And I was like, do you know what? I'm going to tell Carrie that I'm grumpy, because it is part of, like, I'm going to talk to her about the fact that I was grumpy to come here. And I know you won't mind being like, oh, Ashley said she was grumpy, like, but she's getting to meet me.
Oh, and also, I feel exactly the same. Yeah. There's days when I look at my week and I book three of these fucking talks and I think, what the fuck is wrong with you? And I'm like, I'm going to have to, and I, my bookshelf, and thank you if you've sent me one, is full of books about death.
Yeah.
Literally at the moment, it's Letting Go, Living a Good Death, Lost Too Soon, Gone Too Young. And I looked at it and I thought, oh my God. What about, like, I thought, right, Magnum, The Crown. Like, sometimes you just,
you just need a break.
But it's also, it's like, it's, oh, again, my therapist said this to me, I always thought, don't open the door, because you, if you open the door to the sadness, it won't stop.
Yes.
And she has taught me, again, big shout out to my therapist, that you can open the door, the sadness can come in for a bit, and that sadness will go, and then it will be
out the window.
Go out the window.
Like R. Kelly in that music video.
And there'll be some different sadness, but I really believe for so many years that, no, the sadness is frozen where it is, and if you talk about it, it will destroy you.
That is so the same. And I think that's why in LA, 4 years ago, when you were like, how'd your dad die? And I was like, you'll never believe a voice I can do, Carriad.
Hi, everybody.
Doesn't that sound like an old robin in a hat?
I'm a robin in a hat.
And you're like, oh, that is a great thank you.
It really does.
I think I thought the same. I thought if I start, it will never end.
It'll never end,
so keep it back. But actually, that's what I'm saying about living in a state of almost upset will cripple you. It went into my neck and my bones. I have back problems from being hunched over, from being stressed, from sleeping in a ball, afraid that someone is going to find me out, or a story was going to break, or someone's going to ask me in the middle of something and I'm going to get upset. But genuinely, just after this hour, I feel a little bit lighter, and like the little twisted thing in me has gone. You know when they say to go for a walk when you've got period pain? Big shout out to all the boys with no experience listening. And you're like, I can't stand up.
Yeah.
But then you go for a walk and it does actually help.
You stand up and you think, oh, being a ball was not making this better.
Yeah, that's better.
Like, oh, thanks.
I genuinely think maybe that's what we have to start doing for our mental health, and part of that is, and for our grief and loss and sadness and upset. Just try and push through it. And yeah, you might ruin someone's night in a pub.
Yeah.
But if they're worth their salt and paper, like, yeah, but there'll be another night tomorrow.
That'd be fine.
I mean, maybe don't go out two nights in the trot to the pub, but what I'm saying is it'll be grand. No one's going anywhere.
Yeah. I think it's really important to remember everybody gets upset. It's okay. There's always tomorrow. And I know it sounds so fucking cheesy, but it's cheesy because it's true. It's a cliche because it's true.
And I think if you don't want there to be a tomorrow and you're listening in, please give it a go. Please give it a go.
Well, on that very lovely note, thank you very much, Ashley, for coming to talk to me.
Thank you very much, Carriad, for having me.
You can follow Ashling on Twitter at WeMissB, and you can find out where she's gigging if you head to ashlingb.com. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast, and you can email us, thegriefcast@gmail.com. Music was provided by the Glue Ensemble, and the show was edited by Kate Holland with thanks to Whistledown Studios. And remember, you are not alone.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.